This is the EWN Radio Network.
She's smart. She's successful. She's an executive. She's an entrepreneur. And she's the chief executive of her story. Who is she? She's you. Welcome to the Power Lunch on EWN Radio Network, your Power Lunch Hour keeping you informed of women in the headlines and making their own news. And now here's your host, Mona Lisa Como.
Welcome to the Power Lunch, sponsored by Enterprise Capital, your business partner for small business financing. Welcome back. It is still a great new 2015, and we are still the only news talk show bringing you women headliners and those making their own news. So the last few weeks, we've been covering mainly women that are making the news, not a lot of honor interviews, and so we're going to change that up for this week. I'm your host, Mona Lisa Como, if you didn't get my name, and thank you for joining us today. We've been trying out new formats and content, as I mentioned, and we're trying to ensure that we have the best feature for our listeners as we carve through and make sure that this is the best show out there for you. First today, we have a special 45-minute interview with a power broker of for C-suite talent for investment firms. Her name is Cecile Munoz. She is the president and owner of U.S. Executive Search Firm. She is an entrepreneur and a power broker of talent in the financial services arena, and her story is a powerful one. She actually has a unique vantage point representing the top-notch executives in the industry as well as firms looking for new executives, whether it's a new CEO, CFO, a chief operating officer, an investment officer. This is what Cecile and her firm, U.S. Executive Search Firm, does for a living. She can tell you the key elements, especially for women candidates, and why we find it more of a challenge and how to overcome those issues. She also shares her own story of how she became an entrepreneur and those challenges as well, but also great success. So it's not just the challenges, it's the good stuff, the good nuggets of how she came to where she is today, and some really helpful tips for both entrepreneurs and executives. So stay tuned for that. But I wanted to tee up next week, because this is we're working on that content right now. We think it's got some really powerful pieces that we want to share with our listeners. And it wasn't originally on our timeline of what we were going to cover next week. We were going to cover women entrepreneurs, but we are switching because we also have to cover what's in the news. And so I want to tee that episode up, and we'll cover more news next week. But specifically, we're going to talk about women startups and how women raise capital for their businesses. And the reason for this is the catalyst for why we're going to be focused on it, and we'll also be talking about this, is the cover of Newsweek magazine. So January 28th, a couple of days ago, Newsweek has a very provocative cover, and Twitter actually exploded after Newsweek's latest edition came out. And I'm going to actually quote from the Business Journal. It said it came out with an incendiary cover. And here's a look at what it is. So the cover of it says what Silicon Valley thinks of women. And what the picture is a picture of a woman who is kind of looking behind her. She's got a red dress on, and she's got red high heels. And she's looking behind her, and a mouse pointer is actually lifting up her skirt. And at the bottom of the title, subtitle, it actually states, I don't have the subtitle there, but it basically talks about what's in the article about how some of the sexism that women face in Silicon Valley. So while you're still, we're progressive, we're still talking about growing new businesses and entrepreneurs, the article sheds a light on some of the ugly stuff behind the scenes that goes on in Silicon Valley. And I'll kind of brief you on what the edition talks about, and I definitely encourage you to get it. I went through the entire article. A little surprised that they didn't mention a lot of the successes that are going on there, and I get it because they're actually supposed to talk about all the dirt, but it is about the rampant sexism in Silicon Valley, and that isn't a new topic. We don't cover that a lot. We usually get to those nuggets when women are talking about how they actually raise capital. We've interviewed startup companies or hedge funds, private equity firms, as well as crowdfunding firms that are focused on women entrepreneurs and the why they do it. But we don't really get into some of the ugly stories that get it as to what women entrepreneurs have faced. Now, I've heard them. They're not a surprise to me. But I also like to focus on the positive stuff because I don't want to talk too much about the negative. But the truth is there is for women who, you know, we're highly encouraging women to go do startups, there's still an ugliness out there in regards to women entrepreneurs and startups and the challenges they face. And so it's not a new topic, but it definitely warrants attention. The cover is an illustration of, again, a brunette in red heels and a short red dress, and her dress is being pulled up by a computer arrow. Well, I'm going to quote again from the Business Journal. The responses range from pure to support to at least we're talking about it. But no matter where you come down on the cover, the most important issue is what is chronicled in the story itself. I'll give you one of the stories in there that's probably the most incendiary, but it is you feel crushed because you hope that this is something of the past. One woman who was working on a company-defining deal with a major PC manufacturer agreed to a celebratory dinner with a male senior vice president at her company. Halfway through the dinner, the man told her he had a present for her. All she needed to do was give him her hand, and under the table, he'd give it to her. The woman stated in the article, and she's anonymous, "I gave him my hand, and he placed it in his unzipped pants," she told Newsweek, and yes, this really happened. Another woman worked on a startup for a year with another older male financial mentor, and she finally felt ready to pursue a round of funding. He took her to dinner, and she expected him to introduce her to VCs or tell her about meetings he'd arranged for her. Instead of her wine, he confessed that he was having a midlife crisis and that he was in love with her, the Newsweek article reads. No finances would be forthcoming. So Twitter, again, it's only been out there for 2 days, and so I definitely encourage you to go out there and take a look at it. Twitter had various ranging emotions. A lot of it was shock. And that obviously was the intent, was to the shock factor. I'll be honest with you, I haven't looked at Newsweek articles in a while, just like I haven't looked at U.S. News and World Report. And the truth is, there's a lot of the content that they used to be well known for. There's so much more competition out there, especially in a day and age where we have 24/7 news media. So you can either get it, you can get it on your Twitter feeds, but I used to be a huge fan of Newsweek, so I digress. Anyhow, haven't looked at a Newsweek cover God knows how long, but I did look at this one. And some of the critics were saying, you know, they criticized Newsweek for even going as far as they did. But hey, it's probably going to be their best-selling magazine so far this year. One Twitter said, "Sad that Newsweek used a skeezy cover image for a hard-looking hit at Silicon Valley sexism," kind of reinforces the point. Another woman, and that was a gentleman that had mentioned that, another woman on Twitter had stated, "To everyone shocked by the Newsweek cover, read inside to see how tame the cover is compared to the women's stories." And there was also support for it. "Dear Newsweek, misogyny is real, but so are great women leaders of their innovations." I agree with this one. Let's highlight those as well, which they didn't cover in the article. And after the initial kind of shock and awe, because if you just looked at the cover, it really grapples you. But when you read it, then you come back, and it looks like a number of people, after they actually saw the cover, they actually then went and read it. Then Twitter started to be filled with a number of people who had their support for it. Kelsey, for instance, on Twitter, and hers was retweeted quite a number of times, "Get beyond the controversial image and read Newsweek's cover story on realities for women in tech in Silicon Valley." Another gentleman had wrote, "I love the shock value of the cover, but more importantly, at least it'll get you to read it." So again, we're going to cover this next week because there's a lot of great content on it, and it is something I firmly believe that is a good conversation point for women who are going to try this new year. I'm hoping to see a number of you new women entrepreneurs out there, or women that are existing in terms of if you're out there already just working on your business and you already have an existing business, it's not a startup, but you want to take it to the next level and you want to raise capital, it's a good conversation point because it still is a problem for women raising capital. But I also want to highlight on the tips that women, successful entrepreneurs and business owners have done to actually raise capital, and also give highlight to a number of great women-sponsored hedge funds, private equity funds, as well as crowdfunding firms that are focused on women entrepreneurs and startups. So we'll talk about that next week. This week we're going to focus, next up is our wonderful interview with Cruz Cecilia Munoz, and you'll hear it. I get excited when I talk to her. She's actually a very dear friend as well. But if you're looking to excel your executive position, you want to move it to the next level, whether you're women or men, this is a great article, great interview. But specifically for men, this is also great. So you can hear some of the challenges that women have especially if you're one of the executives trying to hire. So when we return, Cecile Munoz, she's the president and owner of U.S. Executive Search Firm. More when we return.
Hi, I'm Sandra Yancey, founder and CEO of eWomen Network. One of my mottos for business owners is, you can't do it alone. Whether you're in the startup stage of your business or you're scaling, you can't grow without relationships to provide support, wisdom, and new customers. eWomen Network is your home to connect with other women entrepreneurs who've been where you are or are experiencing the same challenges. We have chapters across the U.S. and Canada that have monthly events featuring our trademarked process called accelerated networking to ensure you get the contacts, resources, and leads you need to grow your business. And once you become a member, you get many benefits, including 2 one-on-one coaching sessions, unlimited access to our membership database, your own personal profile page, and discounts on products and services with our business partners such as UPS and American Express Open. Join the eWomen Network community and let us help you live your dream. For details, visit eWomenNetwork.com.
Did you know banks decline more commercial loans than they approve? In fact, national banks approve less than 20% of all business loans submitted. And that doesn't include the loans that don't even qualify. But at InterParis Capital, we are here to overcome those odds. We are a nationally recognized commercial brokerage firm with access to thousands of public and private lending institutions. That means we have more options to finance you than your bank does, whether you are a startup or in need of debt refinancing or growth capital, we can help. We do the heavy lifting so you can focus on running your business. Contact us today for a free consultation with one of our business advisors at 855-365-1930. At InterParis Capital, we are your business partner in finance.
You're connected to the EWN Radio Network.
She's smart. She's successful. She's an executive. She's an entrepreneur. And she's the chief executive of her story. Who is she? She's you. Welcome to the Power Lunch on EWN Radio Network, your Power Lunch Hour keeping you informed of women in the headlines and making their own news. And now here's your host, Mona Lisa Como.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our second segment. I am so excited to bring to you another woman headliner who's making news and helping women also, as well as men, and moving folks into the C-suite. She's a phenomenal C-suite individual as well as entrepreneur. And here on our guest today on the show is Cecile Munoz. She is the president and CEO of U.S. Executive Search. Cecile?
Good morning, Mona Lisa.
How are you
today? Thank you for having me. I'm great, thanks. How are you?
So talk to us a little bit about your firm and how you created it.
Yes, thank you for that. I come from financial services. I was an analyst, investment analyst out of undergrad, and really fell upon this career when I was looking to move back west to be closer to my family. And thank God for taking an exit off of the freeway of life when you think you have it so perfectly planned. I did begin this firm in 1992. With a single purpose to focus only in financial services because I felt that I had something to contribute. And I've got to tell you, it's vastly different in today than was in 1992. And yes, I actually was called a triple minority once by a well-meaning executive who was giving me a tremendous amount of business. And what he meant was that I was therefore I didn't necessarily argue too hard with him, that I was a female, I was Hispanic, and I was relatively young back then in financial services. So it began as a single thought and purpose in my mind that I had deep skill set and subject matter expertise to bring to the executive search world. And I also felt that I had perhaps a different voice to share to an industry that was dominated by very large publicly traded companies. And I think it's that single thought of I have something to contribute and I have something of meaning to contribute that led me to begin the firm and grow it from there.
And so you started this, as you had stated. Well, first of all, I've got a comment on the triple minority. I've never heard that, but I love it. And it probably was in an era where folks just kind of said what they mean because there really was no HR back when you were trying to enter into this, as I presume.
And they actually, he actually saw it as a compliment. He actually was complimenting me in his mind, overcoming what he saw were barriers that most individuals would not overcome. Now, I am by far not alone in overcoming those barriers, but I think it's a great indication of the mindset that existed then, and to some degree, it still exists today.
I agree. Now, as you started your company, and you know, especially for a lot of the entrepreneurs that are out there, how have you had to adapt since you started the firm? I mean, it's been at least over a decade. And as you had stated, you know, it would be great if you could talk about, you know, 9/11 as well, because I know that that had a tremendous impact. You've obviously had to adjust in order to stay alive and, again, very competitive. What tools have you done, and what do you think has been the key to keeping your firm going?
That's a great question. I think that when I look at my business and I look at how I'm going to propel myself forward on a daily basis and an annual basis, from my perspective, you have to look at it in multiple factors. You cannot just look at it from a profitability perspective. You cannot look at it just from a brand perspective. I believe that you also have to look at it from a knowledge perspective. I'm a huge believer on ongoing education as a form of a tool to help you transform not only yourself as an individual, but also yourself as a business owner. So speaking of the latter first, what I think has propelled my business is that I have remained and has my staff very much in tune as to what is happening in the market. The sea changes that happen for positive reasons and unfortunately negative reasons, and our commitment has always been to not be executive recruiters. The term also is headhunters, and I tell my staff that is not a good name and it's not a good moniker, and we have to fight every day against that image. So we have become partners in thought versus partners in a service to our clients. And what I mean by partners in thought is to be almost futurist, constantly looking as to where the market is going, because until the machines take over, every business on this planet will have a human component to it, either the buyer, the seller, the service, or whomever is making the product. So we are in the business of bringing brilliant human capital, that's our end product, if you will, to our clients. But it's the process of getting there that I think is our differentiator in what we have consistently remained on the forefront of, to think about where is the business moving, what changes are happening that we need to be aware of, and how does that affect skill set, how does that affect talent. You mentioned 9/11. That had a tremendous disruptive effect in this country on many factors. Speaking specifically now in human capital, Wall Street was the epicenter of the world, financial services world. Quite literally, firms realized that they could not have the bulk of their executives in one spot because, of course, of the unfortunate disruptive nature if that was no more. So as firms began to think about how do we create an ability to have our executives not be based just in one location, but be based on a national basis, that rippling effect to me was positive in that no longer was I not a serious executive recruiter because I was in Los Angeles and not in Wall Street, but it allowed us to bring thought leadership to our clients to say, if you are now fundamentally changing your paradigm of all the executives are in one place, what thought leadership can we bring to you about what we know about the different dynamics of executives across the country? The next disruptive event, of course, was the crash of the market. That had a branding impact in financial services, but it also had a similar shift that happened in 9/11 when that human capital stopped looking at their career solely in terms of financial success and career development. They actually started asking themselves, what does this all mean to me? And I have to find a balance between work and life. And many of them were almost embarrassed to ask that question and to say, Cecile, gosh, I'm looking for this also in my career. It can't just be about the title of the money. I have to have some sort of a balance in my 80-hour work week. And when we were thought partners to our clients and we brought that very human approach to our assessment of talent, it only allowed us to become stronger partners to our clients, and I think that has been our differentiating factor, and I think that has been the reason why we have been able to continue to succeed and evolve and be thought leaders with our clients through through the decades, which, Mona Lisa, it's actually coming up to 22 years, I hate to say, but I'm also very proud to say.
Well, that's because you started at 5 years old, so you're a young puppy at this, right?
That's right. That's right. I'll believe it if you believe it, Mona Lisa.
Works for me. I just keep celebrating my 18th birthday whenever it comes to that point. Now, you brought up a couple of things that I wanted to follow up on. You know, the sea of change that you mentioned, which I think has been, you're really getting to ride the tidal wave, not only in terms of the way the generational shift in how you recruit talent and what talent wants now. You've also been able to see companies transform, because I think, in fairness for perspective for folks that have not been on Wall Street, some of our listeners out there, or many of our listeners out there, it's a rigid industry where when we entered it, it was, you know, this is our way or you don't get to play. And women wore stockings at Goldman Sachs in the 90s and skirts, and it was extremely formal. And there was never an emphasis on culture. There was never an emphasis on balance. And now, and I can say this personally, having worked with you, as we talk about the shift, again, going back to the way it was, and now the way it is, and you differentiating yourself, how are the companies now changing? Not just, it's interesting to hear that executives are now saying, Cecile, if you're going to represent me, these are the core values that I stand. This is the kind of company that I want to be a part of. And again, I think 20 years ago, no one dared say those things to an executive recruiter. How are the companies now coming to you with different value sets? Are they saying things differently in terms of what they're looking for candidates?
Yes, they are. And for the most part, we are seeing an acknowledgement that they have to bring greater diversity to their workforce. And the way I present it to a client is to say, don't look at just an initiative for diversity or gender diversity. Look at empowering your firm to bring diversity of thought and to, number one, and number two, to mirror clients. And you're right, Wall Street is unlike any, or financial services is unlike any other industry, I think, in our nation. It has been predominantly white male driven, and even our communication is very male-centric. We speak from a very male-centric voice. That is certainly changing. But I think the smart firms are recognizing that the data that has been in front of them for at least several years, and that is that greater than 50% of this nation's population are women. The fastest growing entrepreneurs are women entrepreneurial firms. And we consistently have a higher entrance of women in graduate school. And, of course, the wealth controlled by women in this country is increasing every day. So I think it's in part a recognition as to how do they communicate better to their end consumer or to their clients. But what they're asking now is they're really asking for to look at talent that brings great leadership, great perspective, and they are asking for us to go out there and find women executives or women advisors. I think the challenge still becomes that men are hired and promoted on possibility, and women are still predominantly promoted on past experience. So they might still want to step up to the plate and hire women, but when it's time to pull that proverbial trigger, they still hesitate because by the fact that there are not as many women in C-suite executive roles as they should be. When you look at a grouping of candidates, you will by force still have fewer women in the pool, because they just have not been given that opportunity. But I think the right firms are looking at, again, creating greater diversity of thought in gender diversity, and they are going about in a very meaningful manner to go out there and find the right pool of candidates that bring the right skills, but also be more mindful of bringing more women leaders into their fold as well.
Now, what I have found interesting about that statement that you stated is it is absolutely true. There's not the pipeline itself is where we suffer from women executives moving our career forward. How much of that, though, is also a mindset from that we have to own in the sense of one is an opportunity and not being judged for what you've accomplished versus your opportunity, but how do women overcome that?
I think there are different factors that are preventing women to have a greater representation in your C-suite executive roles. And to me, there is the institutional mindset, which is the barriers that are inherent within the infrastructure and organization, what I call the core structure or the core ecosystem. And then there are those that we ourselves impose upon ourselves that are holding us back, and I'll focus on the latter first. I think that it is a combination of nature and nurture. I think part of it is the social norms under which we still live, and the inner communication, as well as the external communication that we hear, that voice in our ear that tells us what we still can and cannot do. But speaking more specifically about three key areas that I feel women, we certainly can address and start taking a more active approach to managing that, again, that inner conversation that we have with ourselves. First is women inherently, we work much harder for the same recognition. We believe that we still have to work twice as hard to get the same amount of recognition or to earn that promotion, number one. Number two, women still hesitate or wait for that promotion to come to them versus aggressively launching a promotion or campaign to get that promotion. And the third is really a function of the fact that women, unless science changes, women are the ones that still bear children. And if you look at the evolution of someone's career at the time frame where you're reaching that level of experience and contribution where you usually start looking at the SVP or EVP role, it's certainly sometime around your mid-30s to latter part of your 30s. Women are waiting longer to have children, and I think in part is because of that career trajectory that they've been in.
That's interesting, because I don't think I've ever heard anyone really line that up. You know, you hear about women holding off on having children more, but I think you've articulated it well, because to your point, if you're getting into your career into your 20s, by the time you're hitting the mid-level to really moving into the, you know, right below the two or three levels below the C-suite, that's if you started right out of college and you were focused on your career, you're going to hit that around your early 30s. And if you've decided to have a child, you know, between that time frame, that's going to push that a little bit. And you know, we'd like it not to, but it's a reality. And if you decide to wait, then that also becomes a problem in the sense that, you know, you've got a bigger responsibility. You know, last week I spoke about Marissa Mayer. She's 39 years old. When she took over Yahoo, she was 39, and she was pregnant. And I remember all the criticism, and I had talked about it, about how she got so much criticism for accepting the helm as the new CEO and then announcing that she was going to be taking maternity leave. So you're absolutely right. There's definitely conflicting interests from a personal standpoint, whether we like it or not. It's some of it's just anatomy-based, unfortunately.
Exactly. And the criticism that she received for taking the helm and yet announcing that she was taking the time to have a child, I think that her intelligence, her skill set did not diminish, because she's taking whatever weeks she's going to take off to have a child. And I would argue that her intensity probably doubled, because she knows,
right,
she's taking time off, that she is probably going to work harder, smarter, and be more deliberate in her approach. But, again, that is a reality of nature. That is not a woman's issue. That is a nature issue, because until we figure out how men have children or how we develop them in a pod, for the species to continue, women will have to keep having children, correct? So,
right.
So if you look,
there's only one way it's happening. It's through a woman.
Exactly. Well, thus far. Exactly. Believe me, when they figure out a different way, I'll sign up to have a child, because, as you know, I don't have children. But if we look at it in the context of not a woman's issue, could we as an industry and as a nation and as individuals have a different impression, a different judgment, and create a different methodology by which we allow women to have a robust career and provide the support needed to care for their children? Because I believe that if men started having babies tomorrow, every major corporation in America would have a daycare center at the bottom floor.
I think one of the perks would be like full-time nannies too, right?
Exactly.
It would be something.
Exactly. So I think it is. There is that piece, but also to come back to that judgment piece, Monalisa, because I think that's very critical. And I spoke out about this once, and I received some positive comments, and I received some very negative comments saying that I was being very unfair to women. I speak from realities, and I speak from the thousands of individuals that I have had the great pleasure of, top performing individuals that I have had the great pleasure of interviewing in the last 24 years. And I'll give you an example. There was a very high-profile position, an EVP and president position for which I was recruiting. There were two candidates that we presented to the client, a woman and a gentleman. Both of them equally talented, equally smart, great pedigrees in terms of education. Well, I always debrief with our candidates after the meeting with especially the CEO of the firm. The woman said to me, first, great people, gave me a top-line analysis of the individuals with whom she met, but then she immediately jumped in and told me where she didn't possess all the skills or all the experience that they wanted. And she finished up by saying, Cecile, I'm extremely interested. I would be great at this role. But she spent probably twice as much of her time telling me what she didn't have and how she thinks she could overcome that. This is her debrief with me.
Wow.
And the gentleman, when I spoke with him, I said, so I always use the name Bob. So, Bob, how did it go? And he said, Cecile, I nailed it. They loved me.
It's in the bag, right?
It's in the bag. And that's that's almost a comical way of articulating how we hyperanalyze, which is a great thing. But if she was debriefing to me that way, believe me when I tell you that there were elements of her demeanor and her communication style, and this woman ran a team of, I think, 75 people in a firm that you would be very familiar with. But yet in her analysis, she spent a great amount of time telling me what she didn't have and how she would overcome it, which is great. But some of that energy, believe me, was expressed during her interview process.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that inner communication that she must have within herself that limited how she presented herself to an individual who could have given her that next step, that next role. And I think it's part of a greater issue that I spent a great deal amount of time thinking about, which is how do we develop great leaders? Because to me, someone asked me, Cecile, what's the biggest advice that you can give someone, that a woman who wants to be very successful in the C-suite role or even entrepreneurial? And that is to believe yourself as a leader and to develop a great sense of purpose, because becoming a leader is an iterative process, and you have to put yourself out there day in, day out, in areas that are on the personal level as well as the professional level that push you to be a leader. Leaders are made, and leaders are predominantly made by yourself, by that person choosing to become a leader. You have to challenge yourself. And in that transformation process, that moment, wherever that is in your life where you have that aha moment that says, I can lead. I can lead from the front. Most of us lead from the back, but I can lead from the front, and I can take the helm of whether it's the parents-teacher network, whether it's a corporation or whether it's of your own family. Choosing to see yourself as a leader and take action upon that will permeate through everything that you do in your life. And so my advice to that individual coming back was, do you really see yourself ready to take the helm of this massive division? And I think the answer was probably not yet.
And so it's that I'm listening intently, because I can absolutely see this in a number of women that I've mentored as well, is that hesitancy, right? And I think in individuals such as yourself and myself, and it, good, bad, or indifferent, it definitely had its struggle, because I don't think the world was ready for much more aggressive women. If you were aggressive and said, I wanted it, it would come off as being a little, the term was aggressive, right? Ambitious, aggressive, but it was always aggressive.
Correct.
And for many women who hesitate, there's that balance. If they hesitate, then it was always she doesn't think that she's ready yet. And to your point, I think the having the intuition as a woman to super analyze or overanalyze your steps is a great quality, because you're very thoughtful. And I think we'll talk about this a little bit later, because I think that also bodes well when it comes to women managing money as well.
Correct.
A company and an executive is looking for someone who's going to make that split decision and is going to have that presence to say, okay, I can believe in you. So when you've given this type of feedback, are you successful, or most of the time are your candidates ready to, the women candidates, are they ready to hear that information and make that transformation, or do you find it's going to take a little bit longer with most of them because it's going to, you know, they're going to have to see that their career's not moving before they really make that jump?
Well, I think that we're in a unique position because the people that we work with are slightly different in and of themselves. They are what you would call traditional type A, or sometimes what I call triple A personalities. But
triple A, I like
part,
that.
For the most part, they are ready to listen, but they can listen as much as they want until they actually believe and take action. And I've been very, very pleased to say that over the years I have had women call us back and say, Cecile, I took action on this, or I took action on that, or I really took what you said to heart. And I may not have started in my professional life, but I started taking action in my personal life, which has eventually led me to take more action in my professional life. I think that they are ready to hear and to take action, but again, we can only fix one part of that equation. The other part of that equation falls very squarely on the institutions and the current leaders at the helm, allowing the opportunities to be available to women executives as well.
And you know, kind of following on that, and then moving into the just women controlling a lot of the money moving forward. You know, the investment news had a great focus on that a few weeks ago, talking about how two-thirds of the women, I think it's high-net-worth women, who come into a relationship have equal or more assets than their spouse does. So it shows that women are definitely coming in from an equality standpoint financially. They're not so much dependent on their spouses as it used to be, you know, in our parents' generations. That being said, even though they come to the table with a little bit more equity in the financial equity in the relationship, they're still carrying a lot more of the burden at home, or they're probably not pushing themselves as much as you'd like to see them, especially from an executive recruiting standpoint. You know, I wanted to make a comment before we move on. What I've noticed, though, is especially in working with you in the last several years, is it seems as if you're also an executive coach. Is that fair? Because I think that's also something that you do. You're not only an executive search firm. I feel like you're an executive coach as half of your job, even though that's not what you get paid for.
I think you're right. But to your point, one of the going back to your original question of how do I keep my firm moving forward, and I made the statement of I'm constantly looking as to where, like Wayne Gretzky, I love hockey, Wayne Gretzky said, the great one, I skate to where I think the puck is going. So I constantly look at where the business is going. And so I realized that I hate to say it, but it was probably about 9 years into having my firm. I realized that I spend a great deal of time with our clients, and maybe it's the analytical person in me. When they call us about an engagement, I ask, well, tell me about the team and tell me why this position is available, or why are you recruiting for this role, and tell me about the dynamics and what are you trying to accomplish, the quantitative and the qualitative side. And we spend a lot of time just talking. And us advising them of perhaps different ways to look at human capital. And then when talking with candidates, I spent a lot of time talking about things that were not on the resume, who that person was. And I think that not only created us as a different type of a firm that brought this qualitative side of that candidate, but I realized that we do spend a lot of time, to your point, coaching individuals. And that is now a part of the offering that we bring the firms from a consulting basis. We don't do that in terms of a formal basis with candidates, but it is my great pleasure to do that. Melissa, and yes, I do as well as my staff quite a bit of that, because in doing that, we really get to know the individual, and that's what has made us successful, and that's what has built strong relationships, and why after 22 years and massive crashes in the market, and in 2009, I think it was the statistics were 62% of financial service of executive search had compressed. They were literally gone, and why we're still here, because of our genuine interest in investment, of finding out who that individual is and what really drives them, what really makes them successful, and what firm and what culture will make them successful in all levels. It can't just be about the money, and it can't just be about the title. Those days, I think, are, thank goodness, are pretty much in our rearview mirror.
Yeah. That's good. And it will be different as you're, you know, you look at the next generation of talent that comes into the pipeline. I do think that they're going to be much more vocal, both on the corporation side, the enterprise that's hiring, as well as the candidates. I think that there is going to be more discussion about what is a right fit, what is a good cultural fit, what, you know, what company fits within their value set or their balancing of their priorities. And so I kind of wanted to shed a little bit of light for our listeners on that as well, because I think part of the equation of your success is also the DNA that of your makeup. So you're a woman, you're a Latina, and you're located in Los Angeles. And we talked about this. I mean, in order to be competitive, everyone on Wall Street, you know, there it was the epicenter of anything, including myself. I had to live there. How have you tried, you know, over these years, how have you taken all those characteristics that are rare for a Wall Street executive search firm? How have you overcome these and made them a strength and a differentiator?
That's a great question, and it's something that I choose to be mindful of every day, because it's those characteristics, Mona Lisa, that can also be my Achilles heel. And so when I speak about what holds women back, that voice in their ear, believe me, I still have that voice in my ear as well. I'm the last of seven, which speaks to probably my drive.
Did you say the youngest of seven?
Yes, I'm the youngest of seven.
You're the baby?
And,
oh, wow.
I am the baby. And believe me, if you had the great pleasure of meeting my brothers and sisters, who are just truly wonderful people, they all have equally big, strong personalities. And my father left us rich with sense of purpose and responsibility. And that was all that we needed to forge our own way into our life and create our lives for ourselves. But I think that that also has some weight to it, and perceived limitations that inner dialogue that was in my ear. But what I have made use of from that is to say, first and foremost, I do look different than everybody else out there, at least my competitors when I first started. And number one, and number two, the way I was raised and my cultural DNA always seeks to understand and always seeks to engage in dialogue. And we always seek to be respectful and appreciative of what we have and want to find the common ground versus create a mountain on which I stand alone. So it's that approach that has allowed me to build a relationship with 54 some odd thousand people in our database, which we developed one call at a time, one referral at a time.
Wow.
And I use the skills of engagement. I use the skills of partnering, building long-term relationships, extended relationships, to serve our purpose in building this vast network of individuals across the country. I also use my cultural makeup, my DNA, as that arm at my back or that wind at my back that tells me don't give up. I very often repeat a saying or a quote that says, if you don't change direction, you will end up where you're heading. The direction that I was born into was a very small town. We had the unfortunate distinction of having the highest teenage pregnancy for, I think, 5 or 6, 7 years running. And although our family was driven by different objectives, that was still the direction that most people saw was a course of my path, of my life. And I believe that if I waited long enough, the world would change, and it was my job to help change the perception of women in financial services, especially of Hispanic women in financial services. And I'm very thrilled at the fact that we are, I believe, at that tipping point. Yes, we make up two-thirds of of women women are entering retirement will be pretty much two-thirds of the population because we outlive men. 80% of women are solely responsible for financial decisions in their lifetime. 70% of married women fire their financial advisors after they have a change event. So when I look at that landscape, I realize that my industry, financial services, has to change because their life has changed. Their demographics have changed. So I feel that I waited out the sea change long enough, and now I can bring 22 years of experience and 22 years of understanding what makes great talent, great human capital, and then what is that wonderful, what I call that Rubik's Cube of human capital. How do I marry that with our clients? And I have had the privilege of building long-term relationships by using the tools that are at the core of who I am, with the drive that has got me to where I am, and that never-ending voice in my ear and that wind at my back that says, don't give up. But it also says, Melissa, don't forget to look back. And I think that's something that I constantly remind myself, and is don't forget to look back and look at all that you've accomplished. And that's what I share with any woman entrepreneur that's just starting. We very often become so focused on accomplishing what's in front of us that
right.
we forget to stop and realize all that we've done thus far.
That's such great advice. And for many of the listeners as well, you know, you're a high power, high energy individual, executive and entrepreneur. You have to have times, you know, as anyone would, but just especially in your vantage point where you sit, you manage multiple companies. How do you manage your competing priorities? What advice would you give folks who are just struggling with there's only 24 hours in a day? And how do you make sure that you're hitting the most important things so that your companies still run and that you're not losing a deal, so to speak?
Well, organizing your schedule is paramount, and that might seem like simplistic advice, but I think it's the easiest advice or the most simple advice is usually the best. And I jokingly say that I know when I'm going to die because I am sure my assistant will have scheduled it in my in my Outlook. And I will have a 15-minute reminder before that happens. So it's first and foremost is managing the top priorities of your day. I live by calendaring and scheduling. I have a phenomenal assistant, a phenomenal team that absolutely understands what are the priority action items on that day. You might have multiple priorities, but they're really within that priority. There are action items that are priority above the priority. That's number one. Number two is having a clear line of purpose of what needs to be accomplished today and what needs to be accomplished tomorrow. I very often think that everything needs to be done today a minute ago. It's having to learn what I can do today and what I can do tomorrow. Having those around me, my staff in both companies and my teams and my partners in both companies, understand where I start and where I end and where they start and where I end and where they end. Number three is realizing that if I'm not going to accomplish something today and that it needs to be done today, how do I manage that? How do I manage that task? And who else do I bring on my team that has the capacity to accomplish that? And then at the end of a typical 12 or 14-hour day is always making time to do something that challenges me physically as well, whether it's dancing or running or yoga, taking a walk, walking my dogs, whatever that is, because I feel that you have to challenge yourself from a different perspective beyond professionally. You have to
That's
remember
interesting that you
said
that.
When I said don't forget to look back, for me,
yeah.
It's don't forget to look back and realize what you're not doing that you love to do that has nothing to do with business.
That is such great advice, and I wish I had met you in my, you know, 20s when, you know, honestly, if you were to ask me, and it's one of the things that I regret, if you were to ask me any movie that happened between 1997 and 2000, I would probably tell you I didn't know, or what was on the radio, because I was so heads down. But if I look and I reflect back on it, I'll tell you that I could have gotten by without dedicating so much of my time and moving my family to the side. And so I think that I love that advice, because when I see so many aggressive individuals, men or women, who are really sacrificing personal, to kind of get to the professional and sacrificing everything in weekends. I know I can speak for myself that it's not worth the sacrifice, because you can still find time. So my question to you, because I think it's different for everyone, how do you balance the personal and professional to give fulfilling relationships to both, you being fulfilled in the career front and you being fulfilled on the personal front?
I stopped listening to that voice in my ear that spoke from fear. Fear of not doing enough. Fear of losing market share.
Well,
fear
good.
Of not being relevant. Fear of not accomplishing X. If I fundamentally believe that I have something positive to contribute to my clients and to the world, and I bring the best integrity and the best intention every day, and I manage my calendar as effectively as I can, and I train the team and have a great supportive team of staff and partners, and if I do all of those things right, then I don't function from fear. And when I remove the fear, the guilt also tends to fall away by the wayside. So the best way for me to start balancing is to say, if you are truly doing all of those things well, then stop being afraid, which, Mona Lisa, I'm going to put you on the spot. Was it part of that? Was it fear? It was fear for me. It was fear for me starting off.
It was fear of losing an opportunity. But
exactly.
what snapped me into it, to your point, what snapped me out of that was watching two men that I competed with that, by the way, they took vacations. They, you know, did
exactly.
their St. Kitts and St. Barts, and they had their families. And what drove me crazy was I got bypassed for promotion after working so hard for it. And these guys still managed to have a family life. And all I could compete with was saying, well, I put more hours in the office. And that really didn't do anything. In my mind, these guys always came back more energized. And I thought that there would be value in just running myself ragged. And there was no gold star at the end of that. I was just ragged. Right? And I had to learn that the hard way. And there was just too much of life that had gone by, you know, whether it's friends, you know, personal relationships, friendships, just even, you know, checking in on your own gut and saying, you know, have I even taken a walk in the last few months? So I like what you say about checking that fear, which also dovetails into the guilt, because I think a lot of women do feel guilty about taking downtime for themselves, because if they're not giving it to their career, then they're giving it to their family. But none of that is just personal me time, right, just for me. And I hear so many women feel guilty about scheduling that or even putting that as part of a priority.
Exactly. And to your point when you said about that I'm also a coach, one of the questions in that partner coach role that I had with my clients, I asked one of my clients and a very, very successful CEO of a very large firm, I said, tell me how you perceive, honestly, just between the two of us, tell me how you perceive a woman who on your team, let's call her Julie, tell me how you perceive Julie, who comes in before everybody, leaves after everyone, runs a team of 12 very successful executives and salespeople, and she's a you know, first in, last out, she's always, you know, giving 120%. How do you view her contribution, her leadership? And of course, he was very supportive. She's phenomenal. She gives everything to the firm. I have never worked anybody so hard. She's seen anyone work so hard. She never takes a vacation. She's great. I count her. She's my rock. Then I asked him to give a similar impression of a gentleman executive leader on his team. And he said, he's great, everybody loves him, he's a phenomenal leader, his staff would fall on their sword for him, he's great, and then he stopped. As I dug further, he somehow saw the woman working so hard as maybe not as confident, maybe not as able to leverage her team, because she had to work so many extra hours.
That is so true. That is... You know, that is so true, because I did have an executive tell me at one point, if it takes you 18 hours, Mona Lisa, with what the guy over there across the way can do in 10, then I need to understand, first off,
why
is it your time management? It's such a good point, because clocking hours in the office doesn't mean that you're more dedicated. It might mean that you have, and that's not true for everybody, but if that's your brand, then it starts to become a negative brand, because then you're not effective in managing time and because you should be able to recharge. You should be able to.
Exactly. In Harvard Business Review, had a wonderful article a couple of months back about the nature of leadership and how different leadership inspires different teams and different talent. And one of the items that they pointed to is this leader who's always in control and calm, cool, and collected, and does find a way to have his or her personal time, and therefore comes back and demonstrates to their team that they have a very robust life, is a better leader. People that individuals aspire to be that type of a leader, that type of an executive. And if we look at the firms that we tend to talk about in laudatory terms about their culture, the Facebooks of the world, the Zappos, the Amazons of the world, we talk about them because they seem to have figured out how to have a work-life balance.
That's true.
We're not talking about them because, like we used to talk about Wall Street.
They're fun to work for. Yeah, everyone wants to go work there because everybody seems happier.
Exactly. And so I'm very cognizant, and sometimes I do a good job of it, and some of the times I don't. It's the realities of owning two different companies. But always being mindful of doing things that challenge me in a completely different way, because in doing that, that also is part of that iterative process of becoming a leader and overcoming obstacles. Strengthening that part of my life, challenging myself in that part of that life. I don't have children. I certainly have lots of nieces and nephews, and I'm very involved in their life, as well as personal things that I like to do, be it dance or yoga or swimming or whatnot, allow me to have that dialogue with myself that says I can overcome and I can achieve. And it certainly gets a little bit more challenging the older we get. And yeah. I walk out of that pool or out of that yoga class or out of that dance class saying, at age X, I still can do. I still can keep up. I still have fun. And I push myself a little bit further today. And so when those days that at the office that are very challenging in 2009 to 2012 were extraordinarily challenging, it also reminds me that this is not what I'm all about. My professional life is a portion of who I am, a very important portion of who I am, and it is a legacy that I'd love to leave behind, but it is not the sum total of who I am.
You know, that's funny you say that, because one of the things I used to say to struggling folks that I used to mentor, especially folks on my team, when they were having problems personally, and they would always say, you know, my spouse or my children, I'm having a tough time balancing. And I would always say one thing that my parents had said to me, which was, what's going to be on your gravestone, hardest working person at X firm or a beloved father, husband, son? And remember that, because at the end of your life, no one's going to remember the 22 years that you gave to the firm, but the people who stuck around you for 22 years are going to remember the times that you were in their life. And so that, to me, has always kept me grounded. And I love what you bring to the table about balancing that and the looking back. And so we're going to wrap up here. I do have a few more questions for you. As you reflect back on your career, as well as your personal life, what advice would this Cecile give the younger Cecile that no one else could have told you?
That being that loud voice in a small town that says, I want something different, and feeling a lot of guilt over that, because it felt like I was rejecting what I was born into. I was rejecting the choices,
right?
The cultural part. I was rejecting the choices that my other brothers and sisters made of staying in a whole small town, and although they are all extraordinarily successful people. And to the outside world, I was rejecting what was my responsibility and my obligation to my family, was to get married and have kids, have a very successful career, yes, but have a certain type of a life. And I carried a lot of guilt around that mindset. And it took a while for me to be okay with speaking up in front of the room. I've never held myself back. I will tell you that. I have always been the first person that raises their hand. And unlike, unfortunately, as statistics show, most women, when it's time for questions and men and women answer the question, if they say two more questions and they ask them, and then the women will put their hand down. But if the man hasn't had his question answered, he'll keep his hand up until somebody asks him that question. Yeah, I was that person that kept the hand up. But it doesn't mean that I didn't feel very conflicted about it. I felt like I was pushing too hard. Maybe I'm doing too much. Maybe I'm pushing too hard. So the advice that I would give myself would be to believe just a little harder in the choices that I was making. And as I said earlier, don't forget to look back. Don't forget to look back and look at all that you have accomplished and continue to evaluate the choices that you're making and see if there are better choices for you to make going forward.
Well, Cecile, thank you so much for being on our show. I think you've definitely inspired both entrepreneurs and executives and just folks that are looking to move their career. I think, you know, me personally, I can relate to so much of your story, especially the cultural, you know, a woman in the industry, which was why I was so excited to bring you on the show, because you've got such a wonderful story. And thank you for giving back to women as well. So for our listeners, if they want to get in contact with you, and I highly do encourage you, if you want Cecile to speak at a event, she's a great public speaker as well, but if they want to do business with you, with the U.S. Executive Search Firm, what's the best contact information for your company?
Wonderful. Let me give you my office number, and my staff will redirect you, as I said, to wherever I may be in the world. That number is 310-557-2495. Our website is www.usexecutivesearch.com, and my email, happy to give that to you, is my initial and my last name. Proudly my last name, because I wanted to remind everyone that I was born a proud Hispanic. It says CMUNOZ as in zebra at usexecutivesearch.com.
Well, thank you again. I know that you will be in touch. You will come back to our show, yes?
Absolutely. It'll be my great pleasure. And Mona Lisa, thank you for all that you're doing for women entrepreneurs and inspiring women to keep on the path, and where you feel that you need to step off the path, that they, if nothing else, can reach back to your show and find the words of encouragement and potential mentors or guides to help them stay on that very true and most important path.
Well, people like you have paved the path and make that easy. So thank you again, Cecile. For our listeners, we're going to wrap up our Power Lunch for the week. We want to thank you again. You can download our podcast on iTunes, and then you can also find us on the website at www.ewnradionetwork.com. We'll be back next Friday with some other great news on women making the headlines, as well as our next new featured guest. We'll talk to you later, and have a great week.